This is a recording of the rulemaking hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on December 16, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning, everyone. This will convene the special session of the Federal Election Commission for Wednesday, December 16th, 2009. I'd like to welcome everyone here for today's hearing. This morning we'll be taking testimony on the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on the Definition of Federal Election Activity, which was published in the Federal Register on October 20th, 2009. The NPRM explored possible modifications to the definitions of voter registration activity and get out the vote activity in response to the decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in Shays 3. I'd like to thank all the people who took the time and effort to comment on the proposed rules, and in particular those who will appear as witnesses at the hearing to give us the benefit of your practical experience and expertise on the issues raised by the proposed rules. I would like to describe briefly the format we'll be following today. We expect to have a total of 7 witnesses who have been divided into 2 panels. Each panel will last for roughly 1.5 hours, probably take a short break between the 2 panels. Each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We'll have a light system at the witness table to help you keep track of your time. The green light will start to flash when you have 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on when you have 30 seconds left, and the red light means it is time to wrap up your remarks. The balance of the time is reserved for questioning by the commission. For each panel, we will have 1 round of questions from the commissioners, the general counsel, and our staff director. There will be a 2nd round only if time permits. I would like to remind my colleagues that we're not required to use our entire questioning time. We have a busy morning ahead of us, and we appreciate everyone's cooperation in helping us stay on schedule. Our first panel consists of Carl Sandstrom on behalf of the Association of State Democratic Chairs, Paul Ryan on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center, and Brian Svoboda on behalf of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee. We will follow the alphabet, which means that unless you've arranged otherwise, Mr. Ryan will go first, followed by Mr. Sandstrom and then Mr. Svoboda. We do have an opening comment by Commissioner Weintraub, and then we'll begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I just want to thank the witnesses and ask them that as they tell us what their concerns are, if you could give us a sense of your priorities, if there is one takeaway message that you want us to walk out of the room with, if you could, you know, let us know that, that would be helpful to us as we're, you know, sorting through afterwards and trying to figure out, you know, we may have to balance various perspectives and various concerns, and so it would be helpful to know if one thing is more important to you than another, and you could tell us that. That would be useful. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Good morning, Commission. Thank you, Chairman Walther. Thank you, the rest of you, for inviting us to testify today. I'm here on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center. The sole purpose of this rulemaking, in my view, is to address the concerns and remedy the problems identified by the D.C. Circuit Court in the Shays 3 decision. The Circuit Court identified 2 distinct loopholes that the Court wants to see closed. First being, and loopholes with respect to the current regulations defining GOTV activity and voter registration activity. The current rules require assistance and thus exclude encouragement of these activities, which the court deems should be included within the definitions of these rules. Second issue is that the current rules require contact by individualized means, thus excluding mass communications, which the Circuit Court deemed should be included within these regulations. The proposed rules fix these 2 problems by first defining GOTV and voter registration activity to include encouraging or assisting people to register to vote and to vote. And secondly, by eliminating the individualized means requirement. The Campaign Legal Center supports both of these proposed fixes to the concerns identified by the Circuit Court. The Legal Center, however, opposes a couple of things put forth in the NPRM. First, the Campaign Legal Center opposes any expansion of the exhortations exemption to communications other than spontaneous statements at live events. The Campaign Legal Center also opposes any exemption for a public communication that refers solely to one or more clearly identified candidates for state or local office and notes the date of the election. Any such communication that meets one of the provisions within the definition of federal election activity should be covered by the rules, in our view. These two, I'm going to mention one more proposal that we oppose, but speaking directly to Commissioner Weintraub's request that we identify our priorities, these two I would identify as our most significant or highest priorities in terms of opposing some things that have been put forth in the rules. But third, making permanent the now expired interim rule exempting certain federal election activities that take place in close proximity to federal and non-federal elections occurring on separate dates. We would like to see that rule not made permanent, but we've been through this before and we've lost this battle a couple of times. I think this is the third time that we filed comments, or perhaps the fourth time we filed comments on this particular issue. So realistically speaking, if I had to choose the battles to lose, I would continue my loss on that one and fight hard to prevent any expansion of the exhortation exemption, and likewise to oppose the exemption for public communications that only identify state or local candidates and the date of the election. And I'll leave it at that. I will look forward to answering any questions you might have to my best of my abilities. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sandstrom?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Commissioners, Distinguished General Counsel, and John. I'm not suggesting John isn't distinguished. John distinguished himself as the finest shortstop the Federal Election Commission ever produced. Unfortunately, I was playing on another team regularly against him. I'm pleased to be here to celebrate with you Groundhog's Day. I think I've been here before on this very issue. And what is quite remarkable, the discussion I don't think has advanced very far. We're still struggling with the very same issues that the Commission was struggling with 7 years ago. Unlike Bill Murray in the movie, you don't have a script to follow. You've just been given instructions to do it right. You know, go back and get it right this time. Now, of course, the legislation doesn't provide you with the definition. And the court didn't provide you with a definition of get out the vote or voter registration. It said you needed to get it right. You needed to do what Congress intended for you to do. And the court was quite confident in their judgment that you hadn't done that. But let's look at what Congress intended you to do in trying to craft what you should do on a going forward basis. Let's first identify that the purpose of BCRA clearly was not to depress voter registration activity. The purpose was not to depress get out the vote activity. If that were the purpose, the court would have found that in McConnell the act to be unconstitutional. In fact, a number of the purpose is not even to prevent non-federal or soft money from being used for get out the vote and voter registration activity. State political committees can use non-federal funds. I'm not referring to party committees, just other non-connected state committees. State candidates, as long as they don't get together, can use non-federal funds. And nonprofits, in fact, Paul's organization can take unlimited soft money to do voter registration and get out the vote. So the purpose clearly was not to prevent these funds from being used. The purpose was prophylactic. What motivated Congress was that maybe the ban on federal candidates raising soft money might be secretly circumvented by not having to the back door, money pouring in to these committees, maybe late at night through the back door with a wink and a nod by federal candidates who would then be corrupted by the fact this money is now going in to get out the vote and voter registration activity that may benefit them. But the Commission is not regulating without experience. This harm, this injury to the Act has never occurred. There is no evidence after two presidential elections that the nightmare scenario that motivated this lawsuit has come to fruition. What we have is a system is working precisely as it designed. You do not find federal candidates and their agents raising unlimited soft money to engage in these activities. There are literally tens of thousands of potential conduits out there. You have evidence of not a single one being used by any federal candidate to get around the ban on their receipt and solicitation of non-federal funds. When we talk about those tens of thousands of committees, I'm here representing the Association of State Democratic Chairs. The association comprises the chairs and vice chairs of all the state party committees and represents the interests of state and local committees throughout the country. Most of those committees consist of volunteers. Most of those committees, you would find it very difficult to go out and locate their headquarters because they're just volunteers. Their headquarters may be the family room in a volunteer chair's home. And we're now going to say, when will they be subject to federal regulation? When will their activities may have to be monthly reported to this commission? When will their activities pose a sufficient threat to the integrity of this law that you need to take further measures to assure that that does not happen? That you have to cut off their organizational activities, their activities intended to encourage people to get out and vote? Because in the materials we submitted with our testimony, I think it's clear what these committees do on a daily basis. They organize. They bring people together. Why? To make sure, like as the advertisement on the webpage of the Texas Party indicates, we want precinct chairs and we want county chairs. And what do we want them to do? Organize people, because come election day, we were going to deploy them to get people out to vote. Does that mean all the organizational activity of every county, every city, and every state committee is going to be brought into these regulations? No, I think what you mean, what get out the vote and voter registration for people who practice politics is a term of art. You would never put in your budget get out a voter registration and think that covers having voter registration forms on the desk in the party headquarters. Nobody would ever budget for that. Nobody would think that answering a few questions about voter registration by a volunteer in the office is voter registration activity. Nobody would think that telling people to vote on November 2nd next year alone is get out the vote. You would fire a campaign manager and say, oh, that was our get out the vote activity. The people who passed this law had a very good idea what it was. And it is facilitating.
Your time is getting close, so actually it's extra, but go ahead. And okay. Just a reminder here.
Yeah, I ran over a lot of times, even when I just had 5 minutes to answer questions. So, in fact, much of what I'm discussing today, I'm happy to expand upon it with questions. But get out the vote and voter registration to the people who practice in this field have a meaning, and it isn't an open-ended meaning, which would include any exhortation to do one or the other.
Thank you very much. Mr. Svoboda?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the members of the Commission for having me here today and to the staff for helping make this possible. And I'm always pleased to yield time to Mr. Sandstrom, so I'll try to be brief. Commissioner Weintraub asked for the takeaway message, and I guess my takeaway message is this. You're here regulating two very different types of entities, and that needs to be upfront in your mind as you write and finalize these rules. The first, which you're going to talk about at length today, are principally state party committees. They were talked about at length in McConnell. They have the availability to spend Levin funds to pay for a portion of their federal election activity that doesn't refer to federal candidates. That's going to be what's driving the bulk of your discussion. But also, these rules are equally going to impact what the statute calls associations or similar groups of candidates for state or local office or of individuals holding state or local office. Rolls off the tip of the tongue, but that's who I'm here on behalf of today, on behalf of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, the non-party legislative caucuses across the country whom they support in their activities, and there's many other types of entities besides who could fall into this category that as yet the courts and the commission haven't had much occasion to think about. So for example, New Jersey law permits the creation of joint candidate committees. If you're running for freeholder and you're running for assembly, you can pool your money together into one bank account and you can have the Swoboda Ryan Committee, you know, putting up yard signs all over Newark. You could have
let's see if that happens.
You never know. Excellent. Notionally, it could apply to a governor or lieutenant governor running as a ticket out of a unified committee. It's not a subject you've had occasion to discuss yet, but if you look at a literal reading of the statute, it could apply to that. It could apply to candidates, you know, who form slate committees to run for school board or to run for other non-federal office. So you have a statute that applies equally to state parties and to an entire group of actors that the courts haven't thought much about and the commission hasn't thought too much about that are engaged entirely in non-federal activities. And one of the problems you bring to this process, not of your own making, but imposed on you by the Shays 1 court, is you have a court opinion saying that you basically have to write one-size-fits-all rules to cover these sorts of actors. You tried, or more accurately, Commissioner Sandstrom and his colleagues tried in 2002 to create an exemption for GOTV and voter ID activities paid for by associations that referred solely to state or local candidates, and the Shays 1 court, at the behest of Mr. Ryan, told you couldn't do that. That, you know, get out the vote is what get out the vote is, whether it's the city councilman in Laguna Beach that's doing it or whether it's the Iowa Democratic Party that's doing it. So that's one of the pieces of the puzzle that you're going to have to address as you write these rules. And there are, moreover, burdens that the commission has yet to confront, and that the courts have yet to confront, in the imposition of these rules on these actors. Let me give you just a couple examples. The first is the Supreme Court upheld the imposition of the federal election activity restrictions on state parties in McConnell, but it said, quote, state committees can take advantage of the Levin Amendment's higher contribution limits to fund any activities that do not specifically mention a federal candidate. The prohibition on the use of soft money in connection with these activities is therefore closely drawn to meet the sufficiently important governmental interests of avoiding corruption in its appearance. Well, the people I represent, the people my clients are interested in, we don't have access to Levin funds. Query whether you have that sort of tailoring that would be sufficient to support these sorts of restrictions. Again, it's a subject that hasn't come up in the courts so far. And it's important for you because you have to draft rules here, or presumably you want to draft rules, that are going to survive across the board.
We would like challenged,
whether by Mr. Ryan and his clients or whether by the slate of city council candidates who find themselves as respondents in a MIR and find themselves in litigation against you. So these are important. What it means is as you draft these terms, particularly voter registration and GOTV, which at bottom everybody does, they have to be defined with precision. So on the one hand, you're capturing what you want to capture with respect to the state party committees, and yet on the other hand, you're allowing sufficient freedom for that genuinely non-federal activity by clients like mine. And so that brings me to an example. I brought reading materials here today. The Selling of the President, 1968, by Joe McGinnis. Read it when I was in college. Had a happy ending, I guess, for some people. But there was, in the book, a newspaper ad that was prepared by one or another of the consultants working for Richard Nixon in 1968. It was going to appear in newspapers across the country. I'll read you just an excerpt of the ad because I'm short of time. But the ad read, the headline of the ad was going to be Tuesday. And the ad read, "It will be quiet on Tuesday. No speeches, no motorcades, no paid political announcements. It's a very special day just for grown-ups. America votes on Tuesday. We'll vote for one of three middle-aged men, all ordinary enough looking, each with a set of mannerisms and beliefs and strengths and weaknesses. And we're not doing anybody any favors when we choose him. It's a terrible job. Our choice isn't difficult. There is no choice. We're going to vote for Richard Nixon. His years of high office, his moments of defeat, and his vital, almost forgotten rests from the pace of public life have blended into a mature judgment that this nation desperately needs. We choose Mr. Nixon with the full knowledge that America will not live happily after November 5th. The next 4 years will test this nation's belief in itself more than any other period in history. On Tuesday, the shouting and the begging and the threatening and the heckling will be silenced. It's very quiet in a voting booth. Now it's your turn. So this is a newspaper ad, presumably ran in 1968. Let's replace America with Maryland. Let's replace Nixon with O'Malley or Ehrlich. And let's say that the ad was run by the Republican Governors Association. Is that ad federal election activity? Is that GOTV activity? Under the proposed rule, I think it is. It encourages to vote, and it informs the reader by multiple means of the date of the election, Tuesday, November 5th. Would it be federal election activity under the under what Mr. Ryan's presented today? It would be. I understood his testimony to expose the expansion of the exclusion for state or local candidates for exhortations to other media like newspaper ads. And also expansions to include informing the date of the election. So that is an example of the sort of communication that you may capture with this rule. How do you avoid, first off, do you want to avoid capturing it? I think you do for the vitality of the statute and the regulation once it obtains judicial review. How do you do it? I think you have to look perhaps less formalistically at the languages that were used by the court in Chase 3, and I think you have to use your expertise as those familiar with how people do GOTV, with how they do voter registration, to capture those spheres of activity that genuinely are intended to mobilize, not simply to persuade people to vote for a state or local candidate, because at bottom, this whole business is about getting people to vote on election day, everything they do from beginning to end, but looking at that special subset of activity that's actually directed toward voter mobilization. That, I think, is the way you can capture what Congress intended when they passed the statute, while protecting the interests of these local committees that have neither the purpose or effect of influencing federal elections, and yet nonetheless will be equally subject to whatever you decide to do here. And I appreciate your indulgence for my running late, and I'll be happy as the others to answer questions.
Thank you very much. At this point, we'll turn to questions from the commissioners. Let's start with Mr. Vice Chairman. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. It's not an easy task that we've been asked to undertake here. We are having to thread the needle. We have a court decision in Chase 3, which did, basically said, go back and try again. And as Mr. Sandstrom pointed out, it didn't give us extensive direction as to how we were supposed to do it. But we know that we have to have a broader definition than the one that we had earlier, and at the same time, we have to figure out how to do that in such a way that we're not going beyond what the statute permits us to do and enter into and federalize state and local party activities that we're not authorized to regulate under the statute. So I guess my question to start off, and I know what the one word answer is, but I'd hope each of you could flesh out your answers, is under the Shays decision, does the commission have any choice other than to go the route of defining voter registration activities and GOTV by incorporating the words encourage or something similar? And if we don't have to go that broad under the Shays 3 decision, what are some alternative narrow definitions that would comport with the decision but that don't go maybe as far as encourage and create the sorts of issues that I know that Mr. Swoboda and Mr. Sandstrom brought up? So that's my first question is can we go narrower than encourage? And if so, what would be some of the narrowing constructs that we could place on that language so that we wouldn't create the issues that you raised? And I guess you could start with Mr. Ryan and go down the table.
No, you can't do anything short of including encourage and still satisfy the concerns of the circuit court. And that's my simple answer, but also complete answer, I think. And I don't really think there's any need or grounds to elaborate on how I would do it differently if you were to decide to do it differently. I like the rule as proposed.
I think it's important to pay close attention to what the court did and why it did it. And yes, I think you can go narrower. And I don't think, you know, as you go out and try to discover how to do that, you do not have to limit yourself to hearing testimony from witnesses. You can go out and discover how these terms are actually used in practice. The people who passed this law had something in mind. We would be better off if they actually defined the terms. But, you know, in every campaign, people know what is meant by voter registration. People know what is meant by get out the vote. And part of your job, I think, is to go out and discover that. And you can do that by making inquiries, doing your own independent investigation. You do not have to rely upon witnesses to tell you precisely what those mean. What the court, you know, unfortunately, federal judges don't run for office. It's not a line item in their budget. And so when they're faced with terms which there's no legislative history on, in which scenarios are thrown out that this would be an opportunity to influence federal elections, of course it's an opportunity when there's a successful governor get out the vote campaign in the same year as a presidential election in that state, it will likely influence the outcome. But that was not what was sought to be regulated. What was sought to be regulated is to, you know, look at these terms and not, as they're used in politics. So, like I said, I would encourage the commission to identify how these terms are used in politics. We've offered now how we believe they're used. They're used with respect to facilitation and assistance. But others in practice, and overwhelmingly, I think you will discover that those people will tell you the same thing. What is meant by voter registration and get out the vote when they budget for it.
I think the word encourage in the Shays opinion was actually a flashpoint for a broader concern that the court had, which was that the commission, in the court's view, had not tailored the rules sufficiently to capture the range of activities that Congress intended when it sought to regulate voter registration or get out the vote activity. So I think less significant perhaps than the term encourage was the actual examples that Shays presented to the court in litigation, and also the example in the Long Beach advisory opinion that the court seized onto as it considered its opinion. From that, I think you have data points of the sorts of activity that the court felt fairly ought to fall within the definition of federal election activity. I think, though, the court signaled some openness. I mean, not a huge amount of openness. It's plain that the court was had difficulties with what the commission had done, but signaled some openness to the exercise of agency expertise to try to flesh out these terms and create a more narrowly tailored proxy. I mean, so for example, we know, I mean, from the first two Shays opinions that it's going to be difficult to support a definition of GOTV that's strictly time limited. I mean, certainly to the 72 hours. We know that. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, from my client's experience, and I assume Mr. Sandstrom's client's experience, I mean, that most of what operatives would budget as a GOTV expense, most of what they would do is what they would discuss as a GOTV program, most of what members would have been familiar with as GOTV when they're writing the regulation, is something that happens in a fairly short window of time before the election. The bulk of it happens in the days or weeks before the election. Very, very little of it happens a year out. So I think that's a factor that you're able to consider as you help flesh out these rules. And also, I think the court may be open to a distinction between, you know, fleshing out encouragement, if you will, to capture what Mr. Sandstrom talked about as mobilization. I mean, not simply telling someone, gee, we want you to vote for Bob Ehrlich, we really hope you do it on Tuesday, but, you know, those more affirmative means that are actually going to, you know, result in increasing turnout in the polls. And, you know, paid advertising, the paid communications is kind of a it's an example of perhaps where it's the clearest example of where the rule may be most over-inclusive. And it's a special concern for state and local candidates because you have a statutory exclusion that's designed to allow associations to do that for them so long as it doesn't take up other, so long as it doesn't otherwise qualify as federal election activity. So that's one of the real dilemmas that the Shays 3 Court didn't think about at all, but unfortunately you have to think about now.
Thank you.
If I could just, one follow-up question. When does, we're all struggling with the definition, is when does something fall from being a persuasive communication? You draw the distinction in your comments about differences between persuasive communications and GOTV communications. At what point do we trip the threshold and enter from the one realm into the other? Is it once we mention the date of an election, once we mention the date and polling place? Does it have to be date, polling place, and hours of operation at the polling place? At what point, and again, I know that these are difficult distinctions to make, but from the agency's perspective, as we're grappling with how to write rules, what are your thoughts on when does a communication translate into a GOTV communication, other than you just kind of know it when you see it?
I think it's not simply just the date, because there's many circumstances where the date's included in a candidate's, for example, own general media track, or just in kind of general creative work in political communication. So I can imagine a number of circumstances where you communicate the date, the week before the election, but it's not for the purpose of mobilizing. It's for the purpose of promoting the candidate in that particular context in which the candidate's running. I think the line is when you go beyond, persuasion, simply trying to encourage popular support for the candidate, which you're trying to do at any point in the cycle, and you're actually taking steps beyond that to mobilize. So for example, you're putting together an office that's designed to help pick up people on election day and get them to the polls. You're doing calls on election day to ask people if they voted and to remind them to go vote and to tell them the polling places. I mean, those are just some examples, and it may be difficult to codify in an exhaustive list, but it points a basic distinction, which is between encouraging popular support and mobilizing.
Yeah, communications costs money. Okay, when I'm getting out to vote, trying to get out my vote, not the other person's vote. And so your messages on a get out the vote campaign and your activities are designed to, as my colleague said, to mobilize a particular segment of the public to an action that is voting, not to persuade them which way to vote, but to mobilize them to action. And that's why most of it occurs, when that action about to occur before election day. Some of it may be about an absentee ballot campaign. But you're not wasting your money a month out saying don't vote on November 2nd so that it will to actually mobilize that person to do anything other than to be favorably disposed to your candidate. And so I know where persuasion, which turns into action, is not an easy line to draw, but you have to look at how in politics people draw that line, because I'm not sure what other experience you look to.
Commissioner Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to follow up a little bit on what the Vice Chair was discussing, and while there may be communications that easily fall into one of these categories, it seems to me it might also be possible for communications to fall into both categories of persuasion and have the information necessary that I think mobilizes is the word that you're using. So while there may be time frames at which it's clearly one thing or the other, as we get closer to an election, would it be possible for those communications to do both? And in that instance, what's your view on where they should fall on the line?
I think it is possible for communications to do both. I mean, clearly the statute is constructed to recognize that they can. In the case of associations, for example, they say you may spend soft money to promote or support a candidate for state or local office as long as it doesn't otherwise qualify as FEA. But that means you have to be, if that exception is going to mean something for state or local candidates, it means you have to be sparing in some degree in defining the other aspects of FEA. it tends not to be a problem so much for state parties, because if they're going to, typically, if they're going to do voter registration or get out the vote, and they can mention the federal candidate whom they are wishing to support, they will mention the federal candidate whom they're wishing to support. The law gives them avenues to do that, for example, through volunteer-exempt activities. But that's captured through another section of FEA, right? I mean, public communications that promote, support, attack, or oppose a candidate for federal office are going to be caught there. So associations face kind of a unique situation. We've got no desire to talk about federal candidates. We don't worry about that first prong of FEA. So the question is, when we're trying to encourage popular support for our own candidates, are we finding ourselves tripped up under FEA restrictions in a way that, ironically, a state or local party typically wouldn't be? And so I think that counsels toward, in this context, you know, being careful and sparing in defining what GOTV and voter registration mean. And one last point to follow up on what Carl said a moment ago. He raised a point which I hadn't thought of before, which I think is interesting, which is the targeting of activities could be a significant proxy for distinguishing GOTV and mobilization from encouraging popular support. Nobody's going to run a GOTV program by taking out million-dollar ads in the New York Times and saying, please vote on Tuesday. You're as likely to get my father-in-law to vote as you are to me, and that's not going to do anybody any good. You know, if you're running a GOTV program, you're going to know who your voters are, you're going to have modeled them and have a sense of what their political attitudes are and their propensity to vote, you're going to know something about their voter history, you're going to know, you're probably going to have ID'd them under separate financing restrictions, the ID restrictions, and you're going to know how they're going to vote, and you're going to have a communication that's basically going to make sure that those people and only those people go out and vote. So that actually is something that the Commission hasn't done before that may be worth considering these rules, which is targeting as a proxy for distinguishing mobilization from encouraging popular support.
And could I add a little to that? Take the example that Brian used, Governor O'Malley. When does the Commission think he can step in and start limiting the persuasive messages that Governor O'Malley and his lieutenant governor on the ticket used to get to persuade their people to vote for him? When does the Commission think they can step into that election when there may not be any truly contested federal elections and limit the message they use to try to win an election? So I think Congress could have attempted, whether it be constitutionally successful or not, to limit the sorts of money that, you know, Governor O'Malley can raise. They can say you have to live by federal contribution limits. You have to abide by all the federal limits on, and prohibitions on corporate and labor funds. Or in Virginia, the same thing. They didn't do that. They said that the danger was a particular type of activity, and that's all we were seeking to regulate. And so if they wanted to take the bigger step, they could have. For you to take the bigger step without clear direction from them, I think would be a mistake.
Yeah, my understanding of the law is that we're not here to talk about what Governor O'Malley can do, what kind of money he can raise and spend through his campaign committee. We're talking about party committees here, and state party committees, local party committees in particular. And I do believe it is, in fact, possible and even likely that a particular communication will fall into both categories of persuasive and a get-out-the-vote type of activity. But Congress was clear that those types of communications, if they constitute get-out-the-vote activity, they're covered by these provisions of BCRA. The Supreme Court was equally clear that they would be covered, and the Supreme Court, I think, in its decision in McConnell, gave this commission the guidepost and the explanation for why Congress could and did constitutionally cover these types of activities. On pages 167 to 168 of the Supreme Court's decision in McConnell, the Court wrote, "Common sense dictates, and it was undisputed below, that a party's efforts to register voters sympathetic to that party directly assist the party's candidates for federal office. It is equally clear that federal candidates reap substantial rewards from any efforts that increase the number of like-minded registered voters who actually go to the polls. Any efforts that increase the number of like-minded registered voters who actually go to the polls." The types of arguments that you've received in written form, that Mr. Sandstrom have made today, that Congress didn't want to or didn't intend to regulate state party activities dealing with state and local candidates. I think it's just not the case. These arguments were made before Congress in the years leading up to the passage of the McCain-Feingold law. Congress addressed these concerns with two very specific provisions in the McCain-Feingold law. Congress doubled the limit on contributions, hard money contributions to state parties, from $5,000 to $10,000. And Congress included the Levin Amendment that allows parties to state parties to raise another $10,000, up to another $10,000, to engage in precisely these kinds of activities, recognizing, again, that any efforts to turn out voters will benefit federal candidates and present this potential for circumvention of the federal hard money limits applicable to the national parties. And then the court, you know, so we have Congress address this issue. These arguments were made to Congress, they addressed. And the arguments were made to the Supreme Court in McConnell. The Supreme Court rejected them in McConnell and explained why the limits were permissible as applied to GOTV and voter registration activities. And these arguments were made to the D.C. District Court and the D.C. Circuit Court in Shays 1 and in Shays 3. And in Shays 3, we're here to discuss today in the Circuit Court decision, the Court again rejected these arguments that Congress didn't mean to or Congress could not have touched or regulated these state and local party get-out-the-vote activities. They're covered. I think the law is clear. It's established. We've been having this argument now for 7 years, and I think it's time for you to adopt the regulation that you've proposed because it makes sense and it complies both with congressional intent, mm-hmm. with the Supreme Court's decision in McConnell, and with the Circuit Court's decision in Shays 3.
Chairman, can I remark on that? Because my colleague Brian doesn't have to be here, I guess, because we were just instructed that this only applies to state parties, that this doesn't apply to candidates running as an together, as a group, as an association. So I thank you, since you now know clearly that this law was to not to cover them and was to cover state committees, my colleague can exit the room. And what he quoted from the court was totally unremarkable. I'm not sure what in, yes, ever when you have elections simultaneously occurring for state and federal office, you know, voter registration and get out the vote activity that's done on behalf of state candidates, by organizations, by state committees, will influence, you know, the outcome. And if Mr. Ryan is suggesting that everything a state party does that actually will help get the favorable outcomes on election day is voter registration or get out the vote activity, then you have now federalized tens of thousands of local party committees who are not now currently registered with you, and you best tell them that.
I'd just like a 1 minute to make clear that
I want to be able to make sure all the commissioners get the opportunity to answer the ask some questions. So we need to keep moving through the commissioners and then come back, I think, with a little more free-ranging conversation.
If I may just...
Sure, go ahead.
I just want to make clear that the Campaign Legal Center understands the statute covers associations of state and local candidates. We believe the rules should cover those candidates. I understood Mr. Sansom's earlier comments to be with reference to a single gubernatorial candidate, not associations of candidates.
Thank you. Ms. Maryland?
Yes, if I might, hopefully, briefly, if we can, so my colleagues have some time. Mr. Swoboda, I liked your characterization that maybe we should think about things less formalistically, and I think you were using the word mobilize, and that leads me to think that, heaven forbid, we need another definition in these regulations, but I was thinking through what the difference between encourage and mobilize is, because I'm assuming you're not suggesting physical force to move voters to the polls. I assume it's something slightly less than that, although I recognize rides to the polls and things like that are obviously included. So I'm curious as to if you can perhaps help me understand a little bit about what you mean by mobilize that is different from encourage.
Well, maybe the best way to go at the question is to talk about, you know, what in my experience, you know, how political committees, you know, think about this. They will
I'm going to interrupt you because I want to make, perhaps I wasn't clear. I think we understand what the activities are. I'm wondering what the words on the page need to look like so that people aren't sitting in living rooms and wondering, and yet we're still being responsive to the court. Right. So is that defining encourage in a way that perhaps is more limited? And again, I'm I'm loath to suggest another definition, but what is shortcoming, what in your views is the shortcoming of encourage, and what's the specific language that would need to be in this regulation, unless it's a laundry list, and perhaps that's your proposal.
Right. Well, one way perhaps to go about it is to frame it almost as like a specific intent standard. So in other words, if you have a committee that is undertaking funds for the specific intent of ensuring that people whom they have identified as potential supporters, and here I lapse a little into the colloquial, with the acts taken with the specific intent of ensuring that those people go to the polls and vote, whether on election day or through early voting or through absentee ballot. And then I would distinguish that between communications that are primarily intended simply to encourage popular support for a candidate. I toss this out without a moment of reflection beforehand, so please take this with a shaker of salt. But it takes you in a direction, I think, that's perhaps safer ground and more precise ground than the encouragement standard, because the problem with encouragement is that if I'm running in 2010, in November 2010, I'm encouraging people to vote for me today. And the question is, but is that GOTV? I don't think that is GOTV. What you're trying to do is to capture those activities that are actually specifically intended to get identified voters to go and vote. And you can adopt perhaps a similar standard with respect, to voter registration. Voter registration is a little more of an easy call because, unlike GOTV, it's not as, it's easy to tell when an activity, it's easier to tell perhaps when an activity implies voter registration. But GOTV is the most troublesome concern because there's a line between, again, that encouragement of general popular support and mobilization. And that's just one thought, I think, toward getting toward that. But I do wonder whether it ought to be more of a specific intent standard.
Thank you. Commissioner Hunter?
Thank you. I think your comments have all been very helpful, and it is very difficult to draw the line here. I think what the NPRM was trying to do is, while I appreciate the arguments that it is quite broad in the definition of encouragement, I think that the examples are probably narrower than the word encourage. And I was wondering if maybe if there's a possibility to submit additional comments, if the record could be open for a few days, to take a look at the examples in particular, and maybe they do a better job at covering the kind of mobilization activity that we've been talking about. That was at least, I think, the intent there. And also, I understand sort of your distinction between the mobilization and the persuasion efforts. And I think that the idea that Mr. Sandstrom talked about, the targeted, who's being targeted by the activities, is a very good way of looking at it. And what I think some of us were trying to get at in the Get Out the Vote activity exemption for public communications, referring only to one identified state candidate, was that was sort of meant to cover a sort of broad category of persuasion communications. So instead of exempting the kinds of get out the vote, voter registration activities that we've been talking about, it was meant to exempt this sort of other side of the coin. And structurally, it's probably not the best way of doing it. I think it probably is better to say that should never be included in any kind of definition of voter registration activity or get out the vote activity. I think that's harder to do. But I think we should take a look at attempting to do that based on some of the comments that we've heard today. And I think if people could take either now or at a later point, look at the examples, and maybe there is a way of sort of putting into paper, as my colleague Commissioner Bowerly is suggesting, coming up with something that better tracks the line between the two. Because I think it's true that encouraging is quite broad. And I'm not sure I'm convinced that the court required us to pick that word. The court suggested it, but there's nothing in the court's opinion, in my view, that requires us to pick that word. So I think if anybody wants to comment on the examples now, that would be helpful.
I would note, with respect to the example that was used, the advisory opinion, the Long Beach, they were not robocalling the other person's supporters. They were robocalling, OK? because they had identified with phone numbers their supporters. And that's why you can argue that that was get out the vote. General political messages that are aimed at the entire electorate generally are persuasive. They're intended, much like the New York Times ad that Brian quoted, to persuade people. And they're given to the people who are, haven't made up their minds yet. When you get down to get out the vote, it's aimed at those who have made up their mind.
Commissioner, I think part of the reason you haven't heard many comments, perhaps, on the list of examples is because of the broad standard that's created at the beginning of the session and the fact that they are it's included but not limited to those examples. I mean, the examples that are listed, I think fairly reflect GOTV activities. In the case of GOTV, the problem, you know, for someone like my client is, well, what else out there is going to qualify as GOTV? Because there's an infinite number of possibilities based on the wording of the regulation that could qualify.
Do you think it's possible that we could come up with an exhaustive list? And I think this list, you know, I'd have to think about it a little bit further. But do you think that that's possible and that's something that people would know the universe?
Provided you don't use the word but not limited to.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. That just, then your examples become fairly useless. It suggests that these are stark cases, but there are others that may be undertaken that are fall into the same category.
Right. My question was meant to, it would be an exclusive list. There wouldn't be anything else besides the list.
My view is that it would not be possible to craft and a truly exhaustive list that would be acceptable to the Campaign Legal Center. We strongly support the inclusion of the prefacing phrase, but is not limited to, before the list of examples that are given in these two proposed rules for both defining both terms. The examples make sense to us, but again, with the caveat being we want to see retained the inclusion of the phrase, including but not limited to.
Mr. Ryan, are you able to give me or provide at a later date another example of something that's not covered that you're envisioning should be covered in the examples?
I'm certainly happy to give it some thought.
Okay. That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Any further questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm a little frustrated by some of this because I feel like some of the comments and some of the discussion, people are trying to re-argue this case, which we lost. I mean, you know, I know that you two don't agree with him, but his side won in court. And we've got a decision to comply with. And honestly, you know, the court decision, I think, is pretty clear in saying that we created a loophole when we use the word assist and not encourage. If we don't use the word encourage, I really don't know what to say when we go back to court if we get sued again and try and say, well, gee, we didn't think you meant it, Your Honor, when you said it opened up a loophole not to use the word encourage. I don't know how to frame that. I don't know what to tell my litigators to say to defend a rule that doesn't use the word encourage. And part of my concern about what you've been suggesting as alternatives is that they both, you, Brian, and Carl, both of you seem to be drawing on intent-based standards. Brian, you specifically said, you know, go by the specific intent, and Carl's comments talk about communications that are not primarily aimed at facilitating the act of voting, and that doesn't seem to be an administrable standard to me, where we would have to get into the intent behind the communication. I'm not sure how we would. What kind of guidance does that provide to your
intent
clients?
Intent often is objective. I mean, you can look at activities and determine that a reasonable person would conclude that the intent of that is actually to mobilize the voters to get up off their duffs and go out and vote. Okay? That a reasonable person can make that conclusion. And then, so I don't think intent is always subjective. It's what a reasonable person who engaged in politics considers to be get out the vote, and that is intended to move people to mobilize and activate them to vote. You know, with respect to what the court, yes, is rather troubling what the court in fact said in many places in that decision. The court essentially said, we don't know what this means, but the commission should be free to determine what it means in enforcement. Well, I don't think that's what you want to do in a First Amendment area, saying that we will determine whether this is get out the vote by, you know, enforcing the law against somebody that we conclude violated it because the.
But that's not what. That's not the section I'm talking about, and that's not the section that I asked about. You know, the court said the FEC's definitions create two distinct loopholes. First, both definitions require that the party contacting potential voters actually assist, quote unquote, them in voting or registering to vote, thus excluding efforts that actively encourage people to vote or register to vote, and dramatically narrowing which activities are covered. And we have to deal with that language.
Okay, if you deal with that language, then, I mean, if you think the court was sufficiently gave you almost no leeway, okay, then you need to cover everything that encourages people to vote from, you know, and if you encourage everything that gets covered, you've completely federalized the system. The court, you know, did not, frankly, think this through as deeply. And is not reflecting.
Sorry, Your Honor, I don't think you thought this through.
No, I'm not saying that's your response, is that for the commission instead to think it through, to go out and gather sufficient, evidence to support its regulation and support it with, okay, what would a reasonable, person in politics consider to be get out the vote? Not what the judge did, because he said that's not his job. The panel said that's not their job to do this, but you didn't do your job adequately. Then go back and do your job, and discover what people in the field consider to be get out the vote.
Commissioner, let me take a whack at it of my own.
Please.
If I'm the Maryland Democratic Party and I send direct mail to my voter file, say in August of the election year, and it says you really ought to vote for Martin O'Malley, am I committing FEA under the draft rules, and am I required to pay for it with federal money? I think I am. I am encouraging potential voters to vote. I'm saying you ought to vote for Martin O'Malley. So what that means is the commission, if it's going to go with an encourage standard, has got to decide what encourage means and how to flesh out that term so you're distinguishing the encouragement, that's going to qualify as GOTV and the encouragement that's not. I think the way I read the Shays case, the court, I think, was frustrated that the commission reviewed a series of activities that it thought, fairly, were characterizable as GOTV and voter registration, and yet the regulations didn't cover them. And I think it was, as it's using the word encourage in this context, I think it's expressing its frustration that there's a range of activity that in its view seemed fairly captured by these terms that should have been there. I don't think that the Shays 3 court would have taken the example I just did, the direct mail on Mr. O'Malley, or the example I read in the beginning of my testimony. I don't think the Shays 3 court would have found either of those to be GOTV. And one other point, Carl's talked frequently about federalizing the process. I want to come at that from a different angle. It's really a statutory problem for you all, because you have a statute on the one hand that says that state parties, local parties, and associations are free to sponsor public communications that promote, support, attack, or oppose solely local candidates, so long as they don't otherwise qualify as FEA. So Congress actually had a statute where it tried to protect even the rights of state parties to be active solely in non-federal contexts. It conditioned that, however, by saying that they can't otherwise qualify as FEA. So the question is, do you define these terms in a way so that they swallow the exception and basically take it away? And that's a very acute problem for associations, because we don't have Levin funds, we don't mention federal candidates or promote or support them, and if the definition of GOTV is so vast as to vitiate that exemption, then we really are violating congressional intent. I mean, I don't want to talk about it in terms of federalizing the system, because I'm not here to second guess what Congress did, 8 years ago, but it's a question of statutory interpretation for the commission that as yet has not been teed up, or at least squarely in the Shays opinions, and is something that we nonetheless need to be mindful of here.
Can I ask one for Mr. Ryan? I know you said this wasn't your top priority, but I'm still interested in this concept of the elections that don't take place, on the non-federal elections that don't take place on the election day, on the federal election day. And I'm wondering if you see a distinction between voter ID and GOTV, because it seems, you know, whereas it seems to me that getting people out, activities that are designed to, for example, drive people to the polls on a date when no federal office holders or candidates are on the ballot, I'm not seeing how that has any impact on the federal election that takes place 2 months later, as opposed to maybe voter ID does. So I'm wondering if you see any distinction between those two activities, and whether there is some period of time, some cooling off period that would dissipate the effect. Is it worse if it's an I mean, we've actually seen some elections that are a week before the election, the federal election, as opposed to 3 months before the federal election or 6 months before the federal election. Is there some period of time over which this effect dissipates?
I know you mentioned voter ID versus GOTV. You didn't comment specifically with respect to voter ID. My view is that the problem is most acute with respect to voter ID, because the products, you know, the results of voter ID efforts have a more lasting effect, perhaps. Getting directly to your question about GOTV, I think it depends entirely on the specifics of the GOTV effort, as well as whether or not you're operating in a state that allows early voting, or whatever the state calls it. If it's a vote by mail state like Oregon, if it's an early voting state, if they call it vote by mail but you don't need any excuse to do it, or even if you do need an excuse to do it, if the window for voting is open and you're permitted to engage, you know, to use soft money to engage and get out the vote efforts, I think it's a problem. I think it should not be permitted. I think it's less of a problem if you're operating in a universe where there is no early voting, there's no possibility that getting out the vote efforts by a state or local party will actually encourage, you know, if you cannot be voting for federal candidates at the time when those efforts are made, then the problem is less, or it's less of a problem, I should say. So that there are variables beyond simply voter ID versus GOTV, and GOTV obviously encompasses activities far broader than driving people to the polls. If we're talking about driving people to the polls on a day when there's no federal election going on, I'm not concerned about that context, but we're talking about much, much more than that in terms of how the commission regulates get out the vote activities generally.
And you think that we should just switch a little bit, gears a little bit, you think that we should regulate differently a communication that goes out and says all sorts of wonderful things solely about state and local candidates, same communication, one mentions the date of the election, one doesn't mention the date of the election. You think that's a distinction that we should formalize in our regulations, as you know, one needs to be done with federal funds and one doesn't. Presumably the one that doesn't even mention the name of the election and only talks about federal non-federal candidates, there's no reason to pay for that with federal funds. Sorry, I'm getting my terms all backwards.
Well, I think if it were to say mention a bunch of state and local candidates, not mention the specific date of the election, but say vote in November, and both elections are in November, I think that is close enough to have it qualify as federal election activity. If a state party is spending a bunch of money to say vote in November, it falls within the realm of the Supreme Court's concerns that any efforts to get like-minded voters to the polls, I think that should be your guide star. And if you hold that up as your
guide. Pages on non-federal candidates, and then one line on the bottom that says, don't forget to vote. Don't forget to vote in November. Don't forget to vote on November 2nd.
If it's printed communication, I think it should be covered. I mean, yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the commenters for their efforts. It takes a lot of time to put this together, and coming here is, for some, a repeat performance, others are repeat performance, and others, I was there and you were up here. So it's deja vu all over again in a different way, I suppose. But I appreciate the effort. I'd like to explore two areas that others have already touched on, but maybe drill down a little bit farther into the details, and pick up on something Mr. Ryan sort of concluded with, that the any efforts language in McConnell should be our guide star. Are you saying that should guide us, not the statute?
No, I'm saying you look at the statute. The statute should obviously be the baseline. But to the extent that questions arise about the statute, the Supreme Court's interpretation of the statute, I think, should be taken very seriously by this commission.
So a facial challenge is actually a construction of the statute in McConnell? That actually construes the statute, and that tells us what the statute means and when it's applied to specific facts?
I think it's very instructive about what the statute means when applied to specific facts.
Okay. I'll take that as a no. That's not what McConnell does. What I want to get at in the statute is there are certain things covered using terms like voter registration, voter identification, get out the vote, generic campaign activity, but there are certain things that are excluded. So any effort to help federal candidate, any effort that may help a federal candidate is not the standard, it's the statute, and there's exclusions. And what I'd like to try to explore is the difference between those, which, as Mr. Sobota has called it, the difference between persuasion materials and the FEA materials. And let's take the example that Mr. Sobota offered in his opening, the newspaper article, or the newspaper ad. Let's assume that you do change the name of Nixon to O'Malley, and let's say it's Maryland. Now, is that FEA? Let me ask Mr. Sobota first.
No, I don't think it is.
Mr. Sandstrom. State party, let's assume it's a local party. Let's finish the hypothetical. Let's assume that local party pays for a newspaper ad that has that kind of language for a gubernatorial candidate.
It certainly shouldn't be FEA. I'm afraid Mr. Ryan suggests it should be. Maybe it needs one of those kind of disclaimers. This is not intended to encourage you to vote. And so anything that state candidates put out together, they put on a disclaimer. This is not intended to encourage you to vote, but just in terms
of like the Canner AO soft money language.
It becomes a little absurd because, of course, if you just leave it as encouraging someone to vote, everything parties do are directed at that activity. All their organization is directed at encouraging people to vote.
Mr. Ryan?
I don't remember the specifics of the ad that Mr. Sobota
gave.
Let's pull it out,
can't we, Brian?
Sure.
Because let's actually talk about a specific example. Because when we talk about this generic lawyer language and all this theory, that doesn't help me. I need to see examples.
Let the record reflect Mr. Ryan's reading pages 147 and 148 of The Selling of the President, 1968.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Cheap paperback edition.
The record will so reflect.
I'm sure he'll cite it as another one.
Just having skimmed it, I believe that, yes, it does qualify as federal election activity, GOTV activity, and if I'm not mistaken, I want to be clear about whether the answers that have been given by my colleagues here on the panel are theoretical or under the proposed rule, and if I'm remembering correctly, Mr. Sloboda, did you not say or conclude your opening remarks by saying that this, in your
okay,
view,
hang
would
on,
be,
whoa,
would
whoa,
be
whoa, hang on, hang on, hang on. I appreciate that. Let's let the commissioners ask the questions. I don't want to step on the chairman's toes and run in the meeting, but let's not ask each other questions on my time.
Okay.
But for the sake of argument, we know where his question was going, Mr. Sloboda. Just clarify.
My view is that it would not qualify as FEA under a fair reading of the statute, that it would qualify as FEA under the proposed rule.
Okay. Let me ask this then, sticking with that hypothetical. Mr. Ryan, what could the state party do if they wanted to do something like that and not have it be FEA?
An ad that simply said, vote for X for governor. I think that type of direct express advocacy without a more generalized encouragement or suggestion to get out to vote generally would not be federal election activity under the proposed rules or under the statute.
So that would come within the exclusion in the statute B1? Because it refers solely to a clearly identified state candidate, would that come with, or just not be subject to the FEA definition in the first part?
Just not be subject to the FEA definition in the first part. You know, I think there's a drafting problem with the exemption in B, sub B, in that it appears to me to be quite circular. It seems to me to say, in short, it's not FEA unless it's FEA.
That's my concern. The only document I have in front of me other than your comments is the statute itself. I thought that would be simpler than to go through years of regs and Chase 3 and all that. So I'm not wrong to say that the exclusion in B could easily be swallowed by A, but we would have to give life to the exclusion in B, right? We couldn't just go into that circle. We'd have to give that life.
Well, I think the problem with the drafting is that either the exemption swallows the larger rule or the rule swallows the exemption because of the poor drafting. In other words, if you read that section of the statute to say that if it's not federal election activity unless it's federal election activity, I don't see any other way out of it other than to have, you know, the rule swallow the exception and the exception swallow the rule.
So what do we do in that instance where we agree, for the sake of argument, the statute's poorly drafted? Do we just cross B out?
Well, I certainly don't think Congress, I would speculate that Congress didn't intend to have the entirety of the rule be swallowed by an exception that takes up one small subsection of it.
But they didn't intend for the FEA rule to swallow the exception either, right? There has to be some limit on what's FEA structurally in the statute. It seems to be what Congress is doing, right?
Well, the limits are given in the definition. You know, it's limited to, for example, voter registration, get out the vote activity, a voter ID, PASO communication. So once you're moving outside of those defined categories of what constitutes FEA, you're no longer talking about FEA. I think they are the limits to what constitutes FEA under the statute.
Okay, let me follow up on that. The comments of Mr. Sandstrom and Mr. Sobota rang true with me insofar as we're dealing with terms in a statute that have a meaning, or at least a meaning, to political operatives and presumably those who voted in favor of this law. Voter registration, voter ID, get out the vote. These are terms that existed before BICRA, they existed after BICRA. And these are not hieroglyphics on the Egyptian pyramids. These are words that people know what they mean. And something I don't think the Commission's done before is just ask a very simple question. And the question, in a way, answers Mr. Sandstrom's question to us, that we need to figure out what these words mean. That's what we're here to do today, I think. So whether we can assume that, let's say you're teaching a class of soon-to-be campaign managers or just giving a public talk, if someone were to ask you the question, what is voter registration, what would a layman's definition of that term be? How is that term understood by those who deal in this world? And I'm trying to help make the record on what these terms mean and whether there's agreement among folks as to what they mean or not.
I think it's generally targeted communications, whether directed in person or through some other through a form of mass communication that is intended to mobilize to activate your supporters to vote.
When you say your supporters, you're talking a certain universe of people.
Yeah, the people you have identified. Again, that's where it kind of fits into voter ID, and that's what they're trying to capture. There are people you have identified as more likely than not that your supporters. It isn't a perfect art, and you rank them when you get out the vote efforts, you know, whether they're a 5, a 4, a 3, to determine whether you're going to, you know, it depends on what your polling shows you, which of these groups are you actually going to try to get to the polls. And it's activities that it is targeted to a segment of the population that you're trying to get to the polls at a time in which it makes sense to get them to the polls. And if you have early voting, it may be earlier than Election Day. But generally, it's around Election Day.
I could.
Let's just do get out the vote. Just let's get out the vote.
What you'll typically see is a campaign with an identified universe of the people whom they think are likely to vote for them, either based on identification data that they've collected, a state party voter file, other lists that they've acquired, or perhaps modeling scores or other data about likely voter preferences. And then it's you, A, take steps to make sure that people are aware of that those people, the identified people, are aware of when the election is and the steps that they need to take in order to vote. You provide them with the information or resources that they need that you can provide them under state law, and it varies from state to state, that would allow them to cast their votes. And then you go through the process, you know, whether through an early vote process or an absentee chase process or on election day, to verify that they have in fact voted. So, for example, in the case of people, in the case of absentee voters, you develop a use of people who you've identified as likely to support your campaign. You send them applications for absentee ballots. You assist them in submitting the applications if state law will let you do that. You verify that the applications have been received and that they've received their ballot. You might call the voter to see if they've received their ballot. You then pester the voter to turn in their ballot. If state law lets you come and collect the ballot and bring the ballot back to the polling place, you do that. If state law lets you drive them to the polling place and return their ballot, you do that as well. And then you take steps otherwise to verify that they've cast their ballots. I mean, so it's a series of sequential steps. It's basically a process to ensure that people know what they have to do in order to vote, that you're helping them to the extent that you can take the steps that they need to take in order to vote, and then you verify that they've in fact voted. And you're doing that with a targeted universe of people.
I would say we've got about 9 minutes left, and I think, if you want to follow up quickly,
I would
make sure
like
the general counsel has the opportunity to answer some questions. And
I'd like to hear Mr. Ryan's answer to the second question.
I'd be happy to answer the second question. On page 7 of our written comments, I'll be brief here, but we, in 6 to 7 in our written comments, we explained that the Commission has for years had on its books definitions of get-out-the-vote activity, voter registration activity. It's specifically now been moved, but it's at section 100.133 of the Commission's regulations, and it defines get-out-the-vote activity as voter registration and get-out-the-vote activities as actions designed to encourage individuals to register to vote or to vote. I think that's a common sense explanation or definition of what the terms mean. I think it's a good that it's been in the Commission's regulations for years, and I'm not sure why the Commission ever departed from that understanding of what those terms mean.
I'd like to, if I could, follow up on that. You have a hypo in your comments, page 2021. Well, it wasn't in your briefs in Chase 3, and I wanted to, I know, Mr. Ryan, your views because it's in your comments, but the hypo says, it's trying to illustrate that the proposed rule may not go far enough. And I read the hypo and I thought, gee, it kind of looks like get off the vote to me. And it says, imagine a mass mailing of more than 500 pieces that says, we urge all Democrats to get out to vote on November 4th between the hours of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. at your polling station at address of polling station so you can support candidates like Mayor Smith. If you need a ride to the polls, call us at phone number. Is that get out the vote?
I think if it's targeted, it is, yeah.
Assuming it's going to people they want it to go to.
Yeah.
Okay.
The one thing I think you might take from your question is we have one person on the panel, my colleague, who is a political operative. And that's a sort of his description of what get out the vote is a sort of description you should seek to confirm and build into your definition.
We're going to move on. Do you have anything more?
No, I'm not done, but if you want to move on, we can move on.
Let me continue so we can get everybody in, including myself and Mr. Gibson, just to make sure we're touching bases before the time is up. Ms. Duncan, do you have any questions?
Just have one brief question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Swoboda, in your comments, you propose that the Commission ought to limit the definitions to cover only those activities that are primarily aimed at voter registration or turnout. And during the conversation during the hearing, I think you've put a finer point on that and articulated as activities that are intended to mobilize, and then more specifically as things that have you've articulated at specific intent standard. And I think, Mr. Sandstrom, you have indicated your agreement with that. I want to just follow up a bit on Commissioner Weintraub's questions about the administrability of such a standard and ask it more specifically in the context of enforcement. Because once rules are adopted, obviously, we have the unfortunate responsibility also in some instances of having to enforce them. How would you suggest that the Commission would actually go about determining whether these activities are specifically intended to mobilize or whether they are primarily aimed at registration and turnout? And wouldn't that put potential respondents in some instances in a detrimental position where they may have to prove the negative that something was not, in fact, intended to mobilize turnout? Can you give us more specific comments on that question?
Sure. In both my written comments and my colloquy with Commissioner Weintraub, I was trying to get at basically the same point, which was trying to flesh out the universe of activities. And when I argued, for example, for a specific intent standard, it was a way. It was not a way of inviting you to look at the subjectivity of the respondent, but to look at what they did and see what you can infer from what they did about what the purpose of the activity is. And so, how you would evaluate that as a general matter, I think you would look to the sorts of things that I discussed with Commissioner McGann a moment ago. You know, were these sorts of things done as part of this process in order to mobilize voters? I mean, one significant element at the outset being, were the communications targeted? I do fear issues with administrability through enforcement. I think your rule obviously needs to provide sufficient guidance. I think one of the difficulties with the proposed rule is that you have the same problems of administrability. I mean, we have three people on the panel, you know, for example, and we've got disagreement about whether, you know, this newspaper ad, for example, would qualify as a federal election activity. So I think that's an uncertainty you're going to buy in any event. I think your best solution is to craft a definition, whatever the standard is, that is narrowly tailored to capture what parties and associations actually do to mobilize voters and is as clear as possible in that regard.
I would welcome the comments of the other panelists on that question as well.
I think if you look at a reasonable person who is engaged in campaign management, what they would consider to be get out the vote, and you should identify what factors are to be considered, whether it was targeted, whether it was done at a time where it was possible to, the voting was taking place or was imminent, that you could sketch out how that test would be applied and would give respondents a whole lot more comfort than a test that relied on the word encourage.
I think the proposed rule would be much more easily administered, and I think you should stick with it. Rather than getting into an intent-based test.
Hey, Mr. Gibson, do you have any questions? Okay. For me, I'll say just briefly, because we don't have much time, there's two minds here that we need to satisfy our collective mind on how we're going to administer this matter. And you know we have diverse views here, and the less there is for us to quibble over nuance of a meeting, the better off it's going to be for us to administer and for our staff. And so it's on my mind that it ought to not only be clear to the people who have to abide by it, but one that we will find one that we can move forward to enforce. And then secondly, we are, you can call it stuck or whatever, different points of view on the outcome of the decision, but we're stuck with some fairly specific words here. And to go beyond those, I think, would be fairly daring. I'm not too inclined to get us back in court because we didn't follow some of the language of the court fairly closely. And I would say, Commissioner Sanderson, you mentioned that maybe we should go out into the sea of information that's there and try and shore up reasons why we can use, maybe vary from the word encouragement, for example. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure procedurally how we could do that and pass APA standards, and I was curious to know how you would suggest that we do that.
And the general counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, the commission can essentially seek independent information on its own outside to bolster what its, you know, questions that are raised during the course of hearings. That your independent investigation, trying to do, you know, I think other agencies do this fairly regularly, to try to determine what the facts are, what is so I think in going out and seeking additional information, an objective fashion that's open and made part of the record would not violate the APA.
I mean, to commission somebody, because we are having these public hearings, we had public comment, to go back and then try and pick particular individuals to give us input, given the way we do our process here. I'm wondering, I'm just wondering, in this particular case,
what agencies rely upon expert judgment gathered outside of the hearing context.
They do.
Commissioner, if you start from the premise that you're stuck with the word encourage, you do have under the APA the discretion to decide what encourage means, I mean, through a rational process. I think you know from the Shays 3 opinion some of the things that they thought to be encouraging. They discussed them at length from the example presented by Mr. Shays and from the Long Beach advisory opinion. I don't think that we know from the opinion necessarily all of the things that they would find to be or to not to be encourage. So I think your task is to take, you know, if you're going to start with that word, I think your task is to flesh it out and see, first off, in the exercise of our expert judgment as an agency, what we think that means. And second, evaluate it up against what the court said in Shays 3 and make a predictive judgment as to whether we think the court would agree with that. You know, realizing that there is also peril in the opposite direction. I mean, every 2 or 3 years the commission considers federal election activity rules, you know, knowing that, you know, Mr. Shays, you know, rest his soul, you know, will may challenge them. But the possibility exists that you may face challenge, you know, from another avenue as well. And that's a particular vulnerability, I mean, with associations and groups of state or local candidates where the McConnell language is thin at best on that. So the commission faces the dilemma it's faced in other contexts, which is you can regulate to the nth degree, but if you pull that rubber band as far back as it'll go, you know that there's some risk it may come back, snap you, and undo the whole exercise.
Well, that's very true. We're here because of a Supreme Court, because of a court decision, and we're looking at the Supreme Court, we're looking at the decision to try and move forward in a way that we won't find us back in court and will, you know, substantially comply with the intent of the decision. So that is the balancing act, and I just wanted to really, for Mr. Sanderson, take a look at what you would suggest we do to meet the APA requirements at this point. I mean, the question can be, can we ignore the word encourage only if we go out and get more supportive language than no opinion of what would be the reason for it? We've heard a lot of testimony back and forth, and we all know the varying degrees of how it might be interpreted or defined or redefined.
The court did not put the word encourage into the statute. It identified activities that it was concerned about that might not be covered. And it used, for example, the Long Beach example, where robocalls were made to encourage people to get out and vote. I can encourage, and this is a very flexible word, I can encourage the commission to do a good job. I also can encourage them to go out and gather additional information. There's very different ways that I am using that word. One is just a general, you know, use, you know, to tell you to do, you know, what the job requires, and others I'm encouraging to actually take a particular action. And so that word, one, is not in the statute. The court is not in a position to put it in the statute. It's not in a position to put it in the regulations. It can tell you that there was certain activity that it identified that it believed was covered by the statute, such as the activity in the Long Beach advisory opinion. And I think you can cover that, because that was what they saw there was robocalls being made on election day to motivate people to vote. They were sent to a targeted audience.
Thank you. Mr. Rand, Commissioner Rand, would you like to finish up your question at this point?
Just actually, I want to follow up with Mr. Ryan on our hypothetical on the newspaper article where I think we agreed that there's a way for them to do it if they only do advocacy for O'Malley. Now, I think that's where we left off. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is my recollection correct that we came up with a way that a state party could do that kind of ad, but it's a stripped-down version that would not be FEA?
Yes, as long as it isn't encouraging people generally to get out to vote, and instead simply advocating that people vote for a specific candidate.
Okay, what if it included the date of the election? Would that change your answer?
No, you know, again, provided that it's not a get out to vote general exhortation.
Well, wait a second. The provided threw me. Would it or wouldn't it be? I mean, assume you're a lawyer for a state party and they prepare this piece and it has go vote for O'Malley on election day, November. Well, it's not going to be November, but whatever the election day would be in our hypothetical, November, whatever year. Would that be FEA?
The addition of the go vote for, I think, would bring it within the realm of getting, you know, get out the vote, encouragement of getting out to vote versus vote for O'Malley.
Well, but it says go vote for O'Malley. You're telling me that there's a difference between go vote for O'Malley and vote for O'Malley?
I think under the statute, yes. I mean, particularly a difference between get out to vote for O'Malley and vote for O'Malley.
Why?
Congress decided to cover get out to vote type communications, and Congress did not decide to cover pure, straightforward express advocacy for a single candidate.
But when you say vote for O'Malley, isn't that encouraging you to go vote?
It may be, but I think, you know, the line exists somewhere, and in my view, that's where the line exists.
But they could include the date of the election so long as it simply said vote for O'Malley. But if it said go vote for O'Malley, as a lawyer, you'd have to cross out go, and then it wouldn't be FEA. You could use state money to pay, but if it had go, you'd have to use all hard money.
I think that would be compliant with the statute, yes.
Okay, that's at least a line. Okay.
This will have to be very quick because we're running into the time for the other panel now.
One quick footnote on your exchange. The state party would be able to pay for that communication with a mix of hard and leavened funds. An association like the DGA would have to pay for it entirely with federally eligible funds.
And so an outside group that's not a party could use all soft.
Correct.
Right. One, if I could, Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up. Let's put another fact in the hypothetical. Let's assume it's the local party doing this piece. And there is no presidential election, there is no senatorial election. And for whatever reason, this local Democratic Party was unable to field a nominee for Congress. So there is a Republican on the ballot, but no Democrat. Okay? And they want to put out a piece that says, go vote for O'Malley on November Election Day. Does that change your answer?
I want to look more closely at the statute and the proposed regulation to give a definitive answer. I don't know if there's leeway within the statute to make a distinction about which party's candidates are on the ballot. I believe the language is an election in which federal candidates are on the ballot, but I would need to review it. My instinctual response, not having done that review, is still covered under the statute.
Common sense-wise, since we've invoked common sense per the Supreme Court, it would seem that the Democratic Party, if they say go vote for O'Malley, they're not getting out the vote for a Republican congressional candidate, right? They can't possibly be really urging that. So there's got to be some kind of line. And if you could, I'd like you to reflect upon it and answer my question, perhaps.
Well, let's say perhaps we can have a written answer if we want to give 5 days to have people provide further comment. But we have to end the hearing.
Yeah, and is that the same deadline for the response to Commissioner
Hunter? I was just thinking the same thing. Let me see what the commissioners think at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
You're welcome. I just have to close the hearing up. 2 weeks, so we pick, is there a calendar handy, pick a date. Let's see. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Whitehead.
If we're giving people 2 weeks, I mean, I'd like to hear if people have any other verbs they want to offer. They don't like encourage. They want to try another verb. I'd be happy to hear it. Or if you have actual wording suggestions for how you think we could cabin in the word encourage so that it would not raise the problems that you are currently concerned about? I'd be happy to hear that, too.
Let me see if I can pick a date.
I didn't realize I'd be getting homework. This will teach me to raise my hand.
Really? Okay. Yeah, that's what you get. Well, if we pick 2 weeks, we're looking at the 30th. So why don't we pick the 4th of January?
Merry Christmas.
That's a Monday. Any objections? If not, we'll pick the 4th of January for their further comment.
And, want to give them till the 6th so that they don't necessarily have to work over New Year's weekend?
Well, you know, the New Year's is Friday, so, but sure. Wednesday the 6th it is. Thank you very much for appearing. We appreciate it very much. We look forward to your comments, and it's been very edifying for all of us. Thanks.